Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Jan Doolittle Wilson is back for the first part of a two-part conversation. I have her cover this Tyrion chapter and the next Tyrion chapter. So the part two won't drop for another month or so, but I thought that there were parallel themes that were running through both of the chapters, and I wanted to get her take on it. I always learn so much in my conversations with Jan, so I hope that you enjoy her insights as much as I did. Here is Dr. Jan Doolittle Wilson. So, Jan, today we start our first of two parts covering Tyrion's sort of most middle chapters in this book.
Right. It's kind of his apex in some ways.
I guess so. That's an interesting, I want to hear you talk more about that, but I felt like I wanted to put these two chapters together because I think that there's some interesting gender discussions to be had. And I thought I could use the help of the Wellspring Professor of History and Women's and Gender Studies.
I will do my best.
In these two chapters, so we're looking at Tyrion 8 and Tyrion 9 in Clash. We have several representations of women in sort of narrative and rumor. And
yes,
kind of covering a cornucopia of tropes. And so I'll just name the ones that I came up with. All right. And notably, these are all from the perspective of a male character and narrated, you know, through the male voice, male eyes, all that business. Women are represented as political assets / pawns.
Oh, yeah.
We have a mother and daughter relationship. We have a child bride. We have rumors of a femme fatale. And maybe a real femme fatale? Well, we can talk about that. We have a damsel in distress, and we have a few damsels in distress in these two chapters. We have a sex worker / love interest. We have the victim of a horrific rape, and so I guess trigger warning on that. More so for the second part of our discussion.
Right.
Discussions of virginity as integral to virtue, and discussions of matchmaking and queen making. I mean, there's just a wide variety of directions we could go. And I'm wondering if you noted, like, were there any others that I missed?
That was very impressive, Anthony. It was a really thorough list. No, I mean, those were all of the things. And you even added a couple of things that I thought, yeah, that's true. I'm writing this down as you were talking. There is so much in these two chapters. And I think that you're quite right to point out all of the gender politics and the tropes and the implications and a lot of those old stereotypes. They're all coming into play in these two chapters.
Right.
And even in the ones before that I kind of quickly reviewed, just in preparation for really examining in depth these two.
Right.
Especially this idea of just really using women as political pawns and using women as a way of spreading rumor and innuendo.
Right. It's not that we don't hear the voice of women in these chapters. It's just that they're framed in a way that kind of almost showcases their powerlessness.
Yes.
I mean, and even like Cersei, who has really interesting agency throughout the course of these books. You know, she's in the room, right? She's in the room of power brokers, and yet none of her objections are heeded, heeded. She's sort of cornered and forced to kind of relent. So even, you know, even the rare woman in the room is almost, I won't say silenced, but pretty close to being silenced.
It's, I thought of that too. When we hear Cersei, when we hear Sansa very briefly, in the next chapter, it's not only just these little glimpses, even Lady Tonda, right? We get these little glimpses of women, but it's all from men's point of view. And I just kept thinking, unreliable narrator, how much of this can we really
Of
trust their
course.
perspective on the women that they're talking about? And doing it right in front of the women. They're having these very open, frank conversations about how can we manipulate and use these gender politics when women are actually in the room. So it's just very normal for them.
Yeah, Cersei does contribute to this as well, right? The way
She
that she
does.
talks about Marjorie's dubious virginity is sort of
Yes.
part of this entire
So we could
conversation.
throw in another trope, I think, pitting women against each other,
Right. Yeah,
right? That
that's
women will
yeah.
always work against each other, fight each other, work for their own interests. And you definitely see that in the way that Cersei
Huh.
is referring to Marjorie.
Right.
She really does come off as, I just kept thinking this as I was reading through, especially chapter 37. She comes off as kind of impulsive. She says what she thinks in ways that the others do not. You know, they're all talking in this very coded language. They all kind of know what the other is saying, but it's always very cloaked, you know, in a certain kind of rhetoric. Cersei, throughout, you know, really most of the first half of this book, she just lays her cards on the table. She'll get better at doing this later on. But one example I can think of is when, you know, Peter, of course, Littlefinger volunteers to be the one to go and negotiate with the Tyrells, which I hope we'll talk about because I think that's really interesting. But, you know, Tyrion responds with his typical sarcasm. I'm trying to look for exactly what he says. But it's kind of as typical. Here it is. It's page 402, my copy. So Littlefinger says, I will be the one who will go. I will, you know, make the sacrifice. And it's actually Varys who pipes up and says, you know, Joffrey is such a grateful sovereign. I'm certain you will have no cause to complain, my good, brave lord. Just, you know, of course, we know exactly what he is saying there. But then the queen was more direct. What do you want, Peter? So it's quite interesting that almost every time she speaks, even when she's trying to, oh, I'm just thinking of Joffrey. I'm thinking of his happiness. You know, he's betrothed to Sansa. What about loyalty? We know that she has another agenda going on, but she doesn't cloak it quite as well, or even well at all.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's gonna be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6-page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. I want to sort of talk about the interior of Cersei that we have to surmise because we don't see it.
Yeah.
You know, Martin almost has to make her more transparent.
Yes.
Because we don't get a POV chapter of her yet.
And it's so great when we do.
Yeah, eventually we will. Let me go ahead and read the synopsis.
Okay.
The small council is assembled again, minus Pycelle. They try, using Varys' rumors, to piece together the mystery of Renly's murder. Tyrion correctly surmises that Stannis is behind it, and quickly moves to match Joffrey to Margaery Tyrell. Cersei objects, but is pressured by all others in the room and relents. Littlefinger offers to propose the marriage, but he will need to think over his future reward. As the meeting concludes, Cersei asks about Tyrion's chain, thanks him for his help, and kisses him. Tyrion commands Bronn to look into what his sister is hatching. Jan Wilson, what do you want to talk about today?
Just a quick observation. You know, the fact that she kissed him was probably much more obvious than if she had slapped him again.
Right.
Because she's never nice to Tyrion. So that was just her waving this huge red flag that I'm planning something because I'm actually being nice to you and kissing you on the cheek. When before, anytime he touched her, she was repulsed. So he immediately knows, aha, there's my signal. She's planning something.
Yes, it's so clear. It's like this is a Judas kiss, right? Even though yes. Judas doesn't exist in this mythology or whatever. It's like, how could you be any more obvious?
Yes.
Anyway, so yeah, that's why I kind of said there's a rumor of a femme fatale. You know, maybe a femme fatale killed Renly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then the kiss makes me think, well, maybe we actually have a legit femme fatale in the room.
Yeah.
Maybe this is when Cersei has already sort of an indication that she's resolved to have her brother murdered. Anyway, that I was going to suggest that later, but here we are.
That's a really good kind of symbol, right? That, and there, I just was so struck, and I'm veering away from Cersei for a little bit, but I was just really struck by all the foreshadowing, knowing what is going to happen. It's just heralded throughout, you know, these chapters, all of these little hints about, you know, things that Tyrion says about Joffrey, things that people say to Tyrion about Joffrey, things that will happen during the battle. It's just really brilliant how Martin drops these little nuggets, and then it kind of comes together, you know, by the end of the book. But if you want to go back to Cersei, I have lots of thoughts about Cersei. You know, I think what you see happening in this chapter, she's pulling out anything she knows from the bag. So she tries being hostile. She tries being pleading. She pulls out the mother card. I'm just a mother, you know, trying to protect my son. And then you're right. At the end, she kind of switches and she tries kind of femme fatale. I'm going to, you know, kind of disguise my intentions through this kind of sweetness. So she is trying in her own way. And again, we have to remember this is from, you know, Tyrion's point of view. And he doesn't really think much of Cersei's plotting skills at all. He doesn't really think she's much of a strategist. I think she'll prove him wrong later. But she's certainly not displaying her best skills in the chapter. And I wanted to ask you, this is kind of what I was thinking about the conversation where, you know, Tyrion just immediately, this is something that we could do to our advantage. Let's turn this situation into something where we could gain new allies. And so he, of course, proposes that they wed Margaery to Joffrey. And Cersei immediately objects, right? And if you look at how she objects, she first says, oh, he's already bound to Sansa. It's a loyalty thing. Right. We've already made a contract. We can't break it. So again, she's trying anything she can. And in fact, you know, Tyrion even responds, oh, marriage contracts can be broken. What advantage is there to marrying Joffrey to Sansa? There's really no political advantage. Her father's
the daughter of a dead traitor, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Daughter of a dead traitor. There's really nothing advantageous about that. Littlefinger, of course, always thinking about money. The Tyrells are wealthier than the Starks. And this, I think, is really the kicker. When Littlefinger says Margaery is said to be lovely and bettable besides, I think that's what really gets Cersei. And if you look at just the language she is saying here, oh, my son doesn't care about that. He's too young. He's made of finer stuff, which is really hilarious, right? Given that he ordered, you know, Boros to rip off Sansa's gown, which Tyrion points out. But here's what I think is going on. If we remember the prophecy, right? Cersei's kind of whole being
I hadn't thought about this.
Is thinking about the prophecy, what Maggie the Frog said to her. And one part of that prophecy is she will be replaced by a younger, more beautiful queen. And so with that in mind, I kind of read this again. And I thought,
interesting.
On first reading, maybe she is just concerned with Joffrey, her baby boy. You know, maybe she is concerned about the marriage contract, right? But what I think she's really thinking about is Margaery will be much harder to control than Sansa.
I thought the exact same thing. I didn't remember the Maggie the Frog.
I think that's what she's thinking about. If she can keep Sansa in place, she knows she can control Sansa. She probably thinks she's more beautiful than Sansa. She knows that Joffrey doesn't like Sansa. So Sansa's not a threat. Sansa can't replace her. And as long as she holds on to Sansa, maybe the prophecy won't come true. But the minute she hears Margaery Tyrell, that is a threat because she's beautiful. She's bettable. She is someone who Joffrey might be attracted to.
So let's talk about that word bettable.
Bettable.
First of all, it's I'm surprised it's a word that's not used more.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it, in this context? She's bettable.
I think that that means, I don't think that means sexy. I think that means that she's of age already, where Sansa is not of age to consummate.
Right.
So when I view that, I think of like, well, that means that Joffrey doesn't have to wait any longer for the marriage to take place. And I mean, his wedding night could be next week instead of waiting however many months or years for Sansa.
And get that pregnancy going too, right? Because that will secure the relationship in the kingdom.
Right. But I'm really liking what you're saying about why Cersei would prefer Sansa. I think that Cersei rightly views her power, whatever little power she has, to be the sway of a mother over her son, and she's losing that rapidly, right?
Yes.
But she still has, like, legit power over Sansa. Sansa's impressionable. She's young enough that she can be molded. She can kind of see a future where she can be in Sansa's ear and Sansa can be in Joffrey's ear, something like that.
Right. And better yet, Joffrey doesn't like her. I think that's a real sticking point, too, Joffrey doesn't really care for her. He's not in love with her.
Right. And on top of all of this, and we don't know necessarily how much Cersei knows about Margaery, but Margaery's older and Cersei will have less, seemingly, influence over Marjorie.
Right. And she has money backing her, too.
Right.
I mean, the money, right? I mean, Marjorie comes from a much wealthier family, and the Tyrells are very much still in play. In fact, they're trying to make this alliance with the Tyrells. So she has to be very careful about how she treats Marjorie, or they might lose that alliance. She doesn't have to worry about that with Sansa. Ned is dead.
Yes. I mean, because I wrote down, like, why does Cersei, why is she advocating for Sansa, you know? And I think that there's got to be some other reason. I mean, the reason she gives is, like, there's no way that Joffrey will take the leavings of Renly or whatever.
He will never consent.
Yes, yeah, certainly she doesn't care. She doesn't care about that. She cares about, she cares about, and she's legitimate in this concern, losing political power. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what has happened over the last, let's say, 50 pages of this book, Tyrion has betrothed Myrcella to some Dornish boy. And now in this chapter, he's proposing to wed Joffrey to someone. And so in a very short space of time, she's lost two of her children to her brother's designs.
Right.
And I think she's thinking, this guy is leaving me nothing.
She is losing everything that her identity is wrapped up in, I think. And I think most of all her children.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that goes back to the prophecy too, right? That she'll lose her children.
Oh, interesting.
So that raises that whole nightmare. Jaime's gone. So that was a huge part of her support, her love, right? So Jaime's gone, maybe dead. They don't know. And then Tyrion comes in and just kind of usurps her position, right? She says over and over, I am the one who should be making these decisions. I am the queen regent. I am the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyrion basically just, again, swoops in. She's very surprised that he's been named Hand of the King. And he makes these kinds of decisions that push her further off the stage.
Yeah, right.
I was also thinking about in the next chapter, going back to how she treats Sansa, I was kind of laughing where Tyrion makes this observation. Joffrey says something horrible to Sansa as they're riding back to the castle. Something like, you know, I'll have one of my soldiers give you a fatal blow. I mean, he says things like this to her all the time. And Tyrion, speaking kind of in his own mind, Tyrion wonders why Cersei doesn't see how terrible Joffrey is, especially how terrible he is to Sansa. And I kept thinking, she not only doesn't care, that works to her advantage, the worse he is to Sansa, because that keeps Sansa cowed, right? That keeps her under control. And it adds to the antagonism in their relationship, which again works to Cersei's advantage. Cersei's just talking to the other people, seemingly oblivious to what's happening to Sansa. The truth is, again, she not only doesn't care, but she probably is pleased that that's going on, despite, you know, what she says about that.
I guess the other thing I was thinking about with Cersei is that when she suggests that Margaery has already been bedded by Renly, I don't think that that's an illegitimate political concern. I wonder if she's kind of voicing the common wisdom that might end up being a political problem.
I agree. You know, I definitely see that. What if Marjorie's already pregnant? She marries Joffrey. There might be questions surrounding the legitimacy of their children.
Right. I was just going to note that historically speaking, mothers have had like a legitimate voice in finding a match for their children.
Right.
Even mothers of kings have had a voice in this. I mean, even Tyrion says in this chapter, when they're kind of debating who's going to go make the proposal, Cersei says, well, it should be you. You're the hand of the king. You speak for the king. And he says, well, it should be the mother, because the mother speaks for the match. And yet she really doesn't have a say here. And I'm wondering if this is because in the backroom dealings, some of these social norms are laid bare, or whether it's just like in this particular case, Tyrion just has all the power.
Maybe both, right? I think that Tyrion, even when he pretends to concede to Cersei, you know, when they're discussing the marriage itself and, you know, Cersei's objecting, saying, I'm the mother. And what if Joffrey doesn't like Margaery? Again, she's just using any argument she can. Tyrion makes a point of saying, he will wed whom we tell him to wed. Mm-hmm. And he makes a point of saying we, but what he really means is me. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he kind of just includes her as a way of again, conceding. But I think it's pretty apparent that he has the power here. And he not only has the power, he has the backing of the men in the room who immediately jump onto the idea. Yes, of course, this is a great political idea. So they're just immediately thinking about how this will be something that will, again, be advantageous to the kingdom, to the crown, to the, you know, to the family, something that will win the war.
Well, and it's that last part that's kind of, I think it's Peter that says something like, look, if we don't make this arrangement, your son might not live to see his wedding day. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as Stannis attacks, the city is going to crumble.
Right.
And so it could be like they're legitimately thinking that this is our last real effort or our last real chance to create an alliance that means something.
Right. Do you think that Cersei is also thinking about how she was basically sold off as a bride? It might be bringing up some of those memories.
Yeah, that can't not be in her mind, right?
Right. I mean, she was basically sold off to Robert because they knew that would be a good political match.
Right.
And would solidify the place of the Lannisters in the kingdom.
And I also think, like, whenever I read these chapters, I always see Tywin's shadow over them.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I always think the reason why Tyrion has the power that he does over her is because she knows that whatever she does to Tyrion, you know, she'll have to answer to her father.
Right. And Tyrion even uses that threat overtly at times. If you don't like it, you can go to father.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But going back to your point about virginity, I think that's really interesting because, you know, again, they want to ensure paternity. It's all about ensuring paternity. And if there's any chance that Margaery could already be pregnant, then that's a problem, right? If they have this kind of hasty marriage, Margaery's already pregnant, then that legitimacy will always be questioned. And it really reminded me, this may be a little off topic, but I remember I was just a kid, but when Diana married Charles, do you remember there was this kind of this rumor, which probably had a lot of basis in fact, that she had to go see a gynecologist to prove her virginity? Oh, do you remember those stories?
No, I do not remember these.
And one thing I remember so clearly is her uncle went before the press right when it was kind of announced that they were probably going to be engaged and vouched for her purity. Do you remember this?
He
basically
this
said to the press,
by the way.
It's so gross. And he said, I can vouch for you that Diana is pure, innocent. She's never had a lover, I think is what he said. And can you imagine being Diana and hearing your sexuality and your you know, private business being told to the world and almost held up like a prized pig, right? That you are worthy because you are pure.
What's amazing to me is that that what I'm reading on these pages are sort of like faux medieval, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they absolutely represent modern politics.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yuck.
It's disgusting, right? But again, they're speaking about this so frankly.
Well, when
this idea of bettable.
Right. When you first mentioned like the you know proof of paternity. The reason why I laughed was I thought, well, this is coming from Cersei, who's...
Yes.
This is her great sin, that none of these kids are Robert's children, right? So
right, right.
So I guess that means that she knows the problems associated more than most.
Right. Isn't there also, maybe I'm thinking of the show, but when Peter goes and talks to Margaery, you know, she makes that famous line about, I want to be the queen. Do they not have that conversation where she suggests to him that she and Renly never slept together? I think she kind of almost has to prove to Peter that don't worry about this. There is no problem in this regard.
I wonder.
Because our marriage was not sexual.
I don't remember that, but I do. But it absolutely makes sense of it. There's just been a couple hints about Renly's sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's enough for us just surmise that, yes, he probably does have feelings for Loras, if not, you know, in a full relationship with Loras.
Yeah.
There's no, I guess there's no real indication that he wouldn't also be able to get Marjorie pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. All we know is that he's very close to Loras. It doesn't necessarily mean that he isn't also close to Marjorie. But it absolutely is a crucial plot point if indeed Marjorie's virginity is at issue. Because Peter is the kind of guy who would know Renly's comings and goings.
And see, that's what surprises me about that conversation on the first page of this chapter. You know, the people in this room, especially Varys and Peter, they say what they think, but again, they do it in this very veiled way. Mm. They use sarcasm, they use innuendo. And so when Varys is talking about how Renly died, all of the rumors that are surrounding, you know, he mentions it could have been this woman. It could have been this woman he spurned.
Right.
I am so surprised that nobody came back with some sarcastic comment about a woman or, you know, just something kind of hinting at the idea of really that Renly was with a woman, because you know that Varys has heard those rumors. You know that certainly Littlefinger has. And so it was kind of surprising to me that that was not injected in that conversation. They just kind of move on from
right.
that.
Yeah, and I think one of them even suggests, like, there's a rumor that it's some woman that he took to bed for his pleasure before the eve of the battle or something, as, you know, I think would have been common practice. But, of course, Renly is not your common king.
Right.
That's an interesting read. I wonder how many people actually, Stannis seems to hint that he knows about his brother's, sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people actually know this. In the show, it's very clear. It's like the best kept secret in the kingdom or something.
Right. And their relationship is very overt. We know exactly what's going on, but you're right, in the book, it's more subtle. And I would have to do another read to kind of pick up on those places where you can tell that people are, that they've either heard the rumors or they have firsthand knowledge that, yes, you know, something is going on here. I honestly can't remember when that occurs in the book, but I know it does at some point. And I guess the first indication I'm thinking of, although it could have happened sooner, is that conversation that Peter has with Marjorie, which I can't remember if that's reproduced in the book, but I know it is in the show. Yeah. So I would have to go back and reread that.
So just to call out the passage you mentioned earlier, this is Varys talking. He says, "My informers are not always as highly placed as we might like. When a king dies, fancies sprout like mushrooms in the dark. A groom says that Renly was slain by a knight of his own Rainbow Guard. A washerwoman claims Stannis stole through the heart of his brother's army with a magic sword. Several men-at-arms believe a woman did the fell deed, but cannot agree on which woman. A maid that Renly had spurned, claims one. A camp follower brought to serve his pleasure on the eve of battle, says a second. A third ventures that it might have been Lady Catelyn Stark." So I think that each I'm always interested in the rumors of this story. I think there's a little bit of kernel truth. And now we know that Brienne did not do it. But you can kind of see, is she a woman that Renly spurned? Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not, I wouldn't say spurned, but there's definitely unrequited love there, I think.
Right. It's pretty obvious to those who see how she interacts with Renly.
A member of the Rainbow Guard? Yes, it was. But that, you know, it's just very interesting to me how these things kind of sprout up and sort of take form in different shapes.
And you're right about the nugget of truth. I mean, the washerwoman comes the closest, right?
Mm-hmm.
She has kind of this supernatural, which made me think, we know how cunning and clever and you know, sneaky Varys is. One wonders if Varys actually knows what happened. And so he is kind of throwing a little bit of the truth in to the mix of these rumors and some more kind of outstanding things as a way of kind of burying the truth, which he might already know.
That's interesting.
It's not too far-fetched to think he might actually have some spies in Renly's Rainbow Guard or his,
you know, and if he comes out and say it was a shadow in the shape of Stannis Baratheon, I mean, he's going to lose all credibility, right? So
right, because they are not at all convinced at this point, right? They immediately go for what is most logical. It doesn't even occur to them. Oh, this crazy washerwoman. You know, of course, the common people believe in, you know, whites and fairies and these things that they've always laughed at. But actually, that is much closer to the truth. Something that they can't see.
Yeah, and we can add to our list of, you know, female tropes, the fancies of an unreliable and maybe hysterical woman that you can't really trust.
Right.
Right. The washerwoman
under the radar.
Right. The washerwoman who has the right of it probably is kind of put into this category of like, eh, this is just old wives' tales.
And might have even seen it happen. You know, these sorts of people are so overlooked.
Right. They're in the room. They're invisible.
Yeah. It's like you don't even know that they're there. And they see so much. And they often do have the truth of how things happen. But nobody listens to them. You know, at least those in the higher echelons. Because why would you listen to a washerwoman, right? She doesn't know what and she's a woman, right? She's not only a washer, she's a woman. So she doesn't really have any standing with them. But those are the people who know what they're talking about. And in fact, those are the people Varys hires as spies because he knows they know what they're talking about.
So then what Tyrion decides is he kind of puts an end to the conversation. You know, Cersei kind of starts to threaten Varys, like, if you don't give us better information, you're going to wind up, you know, out of the council or something. And Tyrion puts an end to this and says that it's probably Stannis because he's got the most to gain. But I think he is legitimately concerned that he was counting on Renly and Stannis depleting each other's forces. Mm-hmm. And certainly, whatever happens, Stannis is definitely the one who's gained from this little interaction.
Which does end up working for them. Because then they can appeal to Loras. They can appeal to the Tyrells who loved Renly but hate Stannis. So he has that great line, but who do they hate more? Do they hate Stannis more or us more? Maybe we can convince them to hate us a little bit less than they hate Stannis.
That's right. All right. So
and that's why they need Marjorie.
So we've been talking a lot about male sexuality so far. There is this little bit in this chapter where Tyrion suggests to Bronn that we should take Joffrey to Shataias because he's 13 and, you know, maybe this is a way to make him like Tyrion better to kind of, you know, feed his budding sexuality and however they can figure out how to do it. But they feel like they need to get him away from the Hound in order to make that happen.
And which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And then, all right, so that's interesting to me. And then I thought, why wouldn't they include the Hound in this? Or why, you know, is the Hound the kind of guy who's just like, doesn't want anyone to have pleasure because he doesn't. I don't know why the Hound would be a roadblock here.
Right. I mean, presumably they could just say, this is our plan. Make sure you stand outside the door at the brothel.
Right.
Right. I mean, why all of the subterfuge when it comes to the Hound? I didn't quite understand that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I've had a bit of headcanon with my sister. And I've kind of voiced this to her sometimes, and she doesn't want to engage. But I thought, I think that the Hound's a virgin. I think that he's, I don't know why I think this, but I think he's like so angry, and maybe he's insecure about the way he looks, and we never see him at the brothels, and he doesn't really. It doesn't seem like he has that kind of appetite on these pages. And yet, Varys says that the Hound does indeed, he says, drinks, whores, and gambles. And so it kind of exploded my little theory. I'm going to have to call my sister and apologize.
Well, that's interesting. As soon as you said that, I thought, maybe that is something. Just because he visits the brothel doesn't necessarily mean,
yeah,
right, that he's engaging in actual sexual activity, although that's the presumption.
Maybe
that's really
intriguing. That's the image that he wants to give off, because it would seem odd, right, for a man like him not to be at a brothel.
And he comes off as, we know that the Hound comes off as this very fierce killing machine, mm-hmm, but look at how tenderly he treats Sansa.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right? Something he doesn't really want anyone to know. In fact, when he kind of has that great conversation with Sansa and tells her what happened to him when he got burned, he really exposes himself and then quickly says, if you tell anyone, I will kill you.
Right, of course.
Because the facade has to remain in place.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's really intriguing. There's something there.
For someone who doesn't, you know, who's someone who kind of hates the mythology around knights, he mm-hmm. certainly curates his own persona.
He is the most knightly of all of them.
Right.
If you think about what happens in the next chapter we're going to talk about.
That's right.
He is the only one who acts the way a knight should, and yet he is the only one who refuses to be called knight.
That's right. That's right. Now, one of the things that Peter has to negotiate when he goes out to make the proposal is that he wants to bring 500 men with him. And then
oh, Peter.
Tyrion says, I'll give you 100. And they kind of settle on 340 or something, you know, that, and mm-hmm. he feels like, number one, he doesn't want to be waylaid. And number two, he wants enough knights to be in his tail so that he looks the part, right? Mm-hmm. He wants the Tyrells to take him seriously. And unless he has a huge knightly tail behind him, he kind of looks low rent, I guess.
Right, right.
I thought that was sort of an interesting negotiation.
It's very interesting. I'm picturing one man surrounded by 340, you know, soldiers and knights, which seems excessive. But I think you're right. It is a show of power, right? If they're to have any kind of negotiating power with the Tyrells, who are a very wealthy, uh-huh, strong family, they have to show this kind of force. But we also know, based on what happens later, that he has an agenda. It's not just, I just want to make sure that I make a good bargain.
Yeah.
We know that Peter also wants his own household.
Right.
He wants his own kind of power. And I think he's thinking, if these soldiers come with me, maybe I can hold on to some of them when I kind of make my move.
Yeah, and I think that that's maybe an under-discussed virtue of the knights in this story, that if you have a knight that looks the part, it can increase your political capital. Mm. I think there's a sense in which Renly really was hoping for Selmy to come to his side, because that would help legitimize his claim.
Yeah.
But just the sheer quantity of knights, actually, Peter thinks will say something about him politically. So
right,
in addition to kind of like, knights are heroic, knights are soldiers, knights do the right thing, there's also a value in just having that presence there to give you the air of royalty.
And that's, I think, especially important for Peter because of his origin, right? Because of how he grew up. He's called Littlefinger.
Uh-huh.
And you can just imagine how that plays into his ego, his sense of himself,
yes,
who he wants to be. This to me means royalty, something I've never really had or been entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
So look at me now, traveling with 340 members of the Royal Guard. You can imagine what that does for his sense of,
yeah,
his own importance.
A guy that was once cut neck to navel by a fierce warrior and a great, you know, would-be lord.
Yeah.
Now he's got 20 knights at his disposal, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, under his command.
And something else you said, Anthony, which I think we can explore much more in the next chapter, is, again, this, you know, very shiny, gilded surface, rotten to the core.
Yeah.
And we see that so much throughout, you know, Martin's writing. But
mm-hmm.
I just kept thinking, again, the Hound, who has this horribly scarred, ferocious outward appearance, is actually good on the inside. And yet you look at these other knights, they have all of the pretense of being a knight. They have all the shiny clothing and the cloaks, and you know, they know what to say. They're called sir, but they're cowardly. Mm-hmm. They think of themselves. They act terribly when a real emergency arises. They beat women. They are not chivalrous.
Yeah.
You know, do you remember we talked about Sansa earlier in a previous pod where she had this very romantic idea of what a knight should be, and that's completely shattered when she comes into close proximity to these knights.
Yeah.
Who beat her on you know, Joffrey's command. So
yeah,
it's very disillusioning. The closer you get, you realize how rotten it really is. And the way they speak about women, you know, how can we manipulate this woman to our political advantage? Mm-hmm. They spread the terrible rumor about Stannis's daughter earlier in the book, right? That his wife slept with the fool of the court. And that's how they got Shireen. I mean, they have no qualms at all about using women, their reputation, their sexuality, their marriage ability, their bed ability.
Right.
If it will serve an advantage to either them or the kingdom.
Right. We're just going to say that the last POV chapter we've had of Sansa, her interior voice says, the hound hates knights. And so do I. So she's almost completely lost faith in that old chivalry that she used to have.
Right.
Yeah, she's seen what they do and how they really act in the real world. And, of course, the Hound is just putting voice to something that she's seen with her own eyes.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about how she just starts getting so much more aware of not only that, but not trusting. And that's a real trait of those who make their way to the top. You know, right? Never trust. And even when Tyrion shows a kindness to her, she still doesn't trust it at first. He has an agenda. The queen spoke nicely to me as well at one point. So you really kind of see that mistrust building up in her throughout this, for good or ill, right? But it certainly is a layer of protection that she has around her now.
Yeah. We learn in this chapter that Joffrey is 13, which we knew before, but here's something that I didn't know before, that he'll come of age in 3 years.
That's right.
So in Martin's world, adulthood, at least for men, begins at age 16.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of been curious about this because I'm trying to parse out, like, how are people measuring childhood and adulthood in these in these pages? And in this, according to this chapter, it's the age of 16. This is sort of when Joffrey can take the throne.
Yeah. For men, it seems to be kind of arbitrary, right? This is an age we have chosen. But for women, it's biological.
Right.
Right? It's after they menstruate.
Yeah, mother nature will determine,
because they can produce babies. Right? Yeah, it's very much tied to their reproductive capacity, which is how women have always been defined throughout history, through their bodies, right? Their ability to have children, how they menstruate. So that part's not surprising. But, you know, again, this idea of 16 is the age we have chosen where men, because there really is no kind of biological marker for men in the same way there is for women. Mm-hmm. Not anything that distinct anyway.
Yeah. I mean, and this actually does make a little bit of sense of a character we'll meet in the next chapter. But I'll save that for our next conversation.
Okay.
Notable introductions in this chapter. Well, we are introduced to Joffrey's potential betrothal to Margaery for the first time. Mm-hmm. I think we're introduced to the age of adulthood for men in this chapter. We learn that both Eamon Coy and Robar Royce were killed by Loras in his murderous rage.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, we, in that Catelyn chapter where she witnesses the shadow monster, she sees that those two men are both trying to kill Brienne. And she's able to kind of fend them off. Actually, both women sort of take a part in fending them off. But then we learn in this chapter that when Loras comes in, sees the dead body of Renly, he kills these two knights. Interesting. So also notable departures, both those.
Can I just
guys?
Say one thing about that, Anthony?
Yeah.
Not that we have to dwell on this. I think it's kind of a minor point, but do you think, I'm of two minds, do you think Loras killed the knights because he thought they were responsible or because they failed to protect?
That's interesting. I didn't think of either of those. I was thinking like, this is a lover's rage.
Mm-hmm. That was my first thought. But then I thought, I wonder if there's more to it. At first, I thought maybe he thought they were responsible. That seems somewhat unlikely. He might have killed them because how dare you not protect the king?
Mm.
That was your one job, and you didn't protect him.
No, that's pretty plausible. I guess I immediately thought, well, this guy was in love with Renly, and so he's lost his mind. And he, I mean, the guy is amazing with the sword. And in that moment, very, very violent. That's how I read it. But
and it could be that.
It could be it could be multiple things, right? It could be that you failed, and so you deserve to die, I guess. Departures again. Baelish departs for Highgarden. And show differences. The suggestion of bringing Joffrey to a brothel is brought out in a very troubling way in the show.
I remember this, yes.
In the show, Rosalind, who initially was a sex worker up in Winterfell, I guess moved around on the chessboard by both Varys and Baelish, right?
Right.
And then eventually she's killed by Joffrey.
Right.
And,
with the crossbow, I believe.
Yes. So, and then, okay, so that was, I felt like a really unnecessary image on the screen. But I think that it's sort of inspired by just the suggestion made in this chapter.
Right. No, I agree. I find a lot of that aspect of the show troubling, as I think many people do. You know, again, kind of using women's bodies in service of driving the plot, right? That was unnecessary, but they have to show that kind of violence to Roz as a way of just emphasizing something we already know about Joffrey,
exactly.
How horrible he is.
Exactly.
I agree. I think it was unnecessary and gratuitous.
Yeah. It's not like anyone was cheering for Joffrey at that point.
Exactly. Exactly. That there was no plot movement at all with that. It didn't tell us anything we didn't already know. And it's just horrific to see that image of a woman on screen like that.
Well, and to bring it, I mean, of lesser concern is the class problem. This is a narrative with so few commoners represented.
Right.
And I'm always interested to hear what, you know, a quote-unquote lowborn person like Asha or, you know, someone who sort of came up through the ranks like Davos. I'm always curious to see their perspective. And
which is why the next chapter is so intriguing, because we do get more of a glimpse, right?
Yep, that's right.
A very violent glimpse, but we do get the people finally.
That's right. So I feel like deleting her from the story was a problem for me, because I want more of those characters. I mean, this is part of my issue with House of the Dragon. I kind of need the downstairs perspective on some of these things, that, you know, the kinds of voices that don't make it into the history books.
And almost all of those women are killed, at least you know, in the book, but also the show in usually pretty violent ways. I'm thinking of Ygritte,
right?
She would be in that category, I think.
Shay?
Shay, certainly. Another very, very horrific killing, which I don't know if we want to talk about that, but that's troubling right, as well. What happens to Shay? And Shay is all over the place in this book too. But she doesn't have a point of view chapter. So we never really understand from her perspective.
Well, talk about an unreliable narrator. Tyrion is just, he's like, I think he's just completely oblivious to his true relationship with this woman. You know, he thinks that they're in love and that he's, you know, she's a damsel in distress. And
it's so complicated, that relationship, because I think he knows, Right. I mean, he does say several times, oh, you're being a fool, Tyrion. Uh-huh. You know, she doesn't love you. She just loves the coin you give her. But he constantly pushes that away.
He can't.
Because
he desperately
doesn't want to believe it.
He's
so
almost
desperate.
Willfully ignorant.
He is. And that becomes his big flaw.
At one point, he actually says something like, yeah, maybe, you know, I'm an ugly man, but maybe Shay doesn't recognize ugliness or something absurd like that.
And I think, you know, we've talked about this, but I do think that's Tyrion's Achilles heel. The idea that he so desperately wants to be loved and can't find it anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe the central theme for Tyrion's arc throughout this entire book. This is kind of why I called these two chapters kind of the apex, because right before this, there's that scene where he's in bed with Shay. Mm-hmm. And this plays into what you were saying, Anthony, where he's totally content. I've just stuck it to Lancel.
Yeah.
I'm using him now for my own power. Uh-huh. I've got Cersei where I want her to be. I've got Shay in my bed. I'm good at this. Life is great.
Yeah.
And so he goes into these two chapters like, I am, wow. Right? I may not be the king, but I'm pulling the strings. And then we get to that next chapter and things begin to unravel. And I think that's why when he is told, is it Jocelyn, the knight,
yeah,
who says to Tyrion, they hate you most of all.
Yes.
That just wounds him like nothing else.
The other thing about this is that in the show, Peter arrives at Renly's camp before Renly's killed.
That's right.
And
that's right. He is there when it happens.
Because in the show, he brings Ned's bones to Kat.
That's right. And that's why he's able to have that conversation with Margaery so quickly, because he is right there when all of the tumult is happening after Renly is killed. And it's really Peter who kind of is the first one to recognize, you know, the political advantage here.
Right. Yeah.
That's a choice. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I do think that, we missed this entire conversation because I think Peter's kind of like doing this on his own accord. Mm-hmm. And I do like the idea of putting Catelyn and Baelish in the same tent for a little bit.
How dare you?
You may have heard false reports.
You betrayed Ned.
Betrayed? I wanted him to serve as protector of the realm. I begged him to seize the moment.
I trusted you. My husband trusted you. And you repaid our faith with treachery.
No, my lady.
Get out!
Kat, I've loved you since I was a boy. It seems to me that fate has given us this chance to...
You've lost your mind. Get out!
Do you want to see your girls again? Sansa, more beautiful than ever. And Arya, just as wild as ever.
You have Arya too?
Both girls are healthy and safe. For now. But you know the Queen, and you know Joffrey. I fear for their longevity if they remain in the capital.
I mean, that relationship is the springboard for so much of what goes wrong in the story.
Right.
Like, if Peter Baelish was not jilted by Kat, how much of the bloodshed could have been avoided?
Do you think that, and you definitely see a lot of hints of it, not even just hints, Tyrion even acknowledges how dangerous Peter is. I think his rationale, and I can't send Cersei off. I don't want to go off. I've got to keep Cersei right by my side because she's the most dangerous. And yet he sends Peter off. Do you think he's really underestimating the damage Peter can do when he's out there?
He knows that I think he knows that it's troublesome to have Baelish out of sight. He said, I don't want him out of my sight, but he kind of clearly neither Tyrion nor Cersei want to go on this maybe fatal mission.
Yeah.
But so here we have the one member of the small council who's actually volunteering it. And it makes sense to send him and that he knows this is going to be a problem. But I feel like Tyrion's thinking, we need this marriage. If we don't get this marriage, we are toast. So he's willing to take the risk.
It just seems like in previous chapters too, he's almost constantly surprised that Peter's as good as he is. Mm-hmm. Right. Where Peter will say, "Oh, wow, you're a really good liar." So it seems like he's a little slow to catch on. Yes, he's a good liar. Yes, he will lie to your face. Yes, it's all about what can I do to gain power.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. I think there's some trepidation on Tyrion's part when he thinks, "Oh, I'm sending Peter out there with all of these soldiers." But I'm not quite sure he gets the full import of what he's doing in kind of unleashing, you know, Baelish out into the world like that.
Yeah. All right, Jan. Until next time.
All right. Thanks, Anthony. Always fun to talk about these books with you.
Me too.